Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of the show, we will be talking about what some people would argue may be the most neglected tool of American foreign policy. And what we're talking about here is cultural diplomacy. Now, as our guest for this hour, Richard Arndt, explains in his book, The First Resort of Kings, cultural relations occur naturally between people of different countries. However, cultural diplomacy is something different. That is something that only happens when governments decide to support cultural exchange as a way of promoting their national interests. In this book, our guest argues that politicians in the United States today have really ignored what is a relatively inexpensive and very old tool for promoting understanding between nations. The subtitle of his book is American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century and explores this territory in great depth. His book is published by Potomac Books, so if you're interested in reading the book, you can go out and look for it. Let me give you a little bit more background information on our guest, Richard Arndt. He worked for the U.S. Information Agency for 24 years after earning a Ph.D. and teaching French at Columbia University. Following his tenure in the Foreign Service, he served as president of the U.S. Fulbright Association. He chaired the National Peace Foundation. He was diplomat in residence at the University of Virginia and also has taught cultural diplomacy at the George Washington University. He is currently president of an organization called Americans for UNESCO and continues to make his home in Washington, D.C. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments are welcome, as always. The number, if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you would happen to be listening around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, use that number. In fact, also people who might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. So again, that number is 800-222-9455. And then for folks who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. At any point here, people are certainly welcome to call. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people try and be brief, and that will help us then get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving along. Mr. Arndt, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you for talking with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
I appreciate it. In the afterword to the book, you write that over the years that you've found there are three kinds of people who never have to ask what is meant by cultural diplomacy. Those are historians, anthropologists, and foreigners. Speaking for those people who are not in any of those categories, I'd better start right off by asking the question, what is meant by cultural diplomacy?
Well, since you have to ask, David, cultural diplomacy is the phrase we use or we have used for in recent years to describe something that mankind has done ever since the Bronze Age. It's why I call the book The First Resort of Kings. The idea is that before you slew your enemies, you smoked a pipe of peace or sold them some wampum beads or whatever in order to try to maximize the possibilities that you could get along with them over time and that you could communicate with them over time. Now, as you pointed out in your introduction, cultural relations happen. People get married, they look at movies, they read books, they travel, they do all kinds of things across national borders. But cultural diplomacy can only really be said to take place when governments or national societies, sometimes it's done by the private sector to some extent, get involved and they say, look, this is too important to leave to just accident and happenstance. We've really got to get in there and make sure it happens more. The greatest example, of course, in American history and perhaps in some regards in world history is the Fulbright Program, which started in 1946 and 47 based on reflows from war material that was left over in Europe. And now, I don't know, about 5,000 or 6,000 exchangees per year, and has done so for the last 50 years, or almost 60 years now, exchange between nations in the effort to try to create a climate of understanding on both sides of any bilateral relation, what Fulbright called mutual understanding.
Mm-hmm. And I think we also ought to draw a comparison between the kind of public relations campaigns that countries, and certainly the United States is among them, wage today, something that we hear more and more about, which is generally termed public diplomacy, that we contrast that with cultural diplomacy. And you seem to be making the argument that as our efforts in the area of cultural diplomacy have withered, that our efforts in the area of public diplomacy, perhaps not connected to the decline of the other, but as the one has declined, the other has increased.
Well, that's one way to put it, David. It's not that the two are in opposition. They have been put in opposition by the creation of the phrase public diplomacy. Public diplomacy is a phrase that only got invented in 1967 for various purposes and lately has taken over the ballpark. So that when you talk about public diplomacy, which is essentially read by the American mind as public relations in the diplomatic field, it is assumed by the public diplomats that it contains cultural diplomacy within it. Well, now that is, to me, very much like putting Hill and Knowlton or one of the great big ad agencies in charge of Harvard. It doesn't make sense, it seems to me. And the cultural diplomats or the cultural exponents who have related to foreigners overseas have always done so on their own steam and with their own tools and with their own natural colleagues. They don't have to be told by some public affairs officer how to do it and what to do. So that what's happened, and it's a long historical thing that my book spends far too much time on, is how it happened. It started in the 1930s as part of the Roosevelt good neighbor policy, trying to be nice to the Latin Americans after years of invading them periodically. It sort of was going off on its own direction when suddenly, with the needs of warfare and so forth and the arrival in Washington of Nelson Rockefeller, it took a very dynamic turn and has been more or less ever since enmeshed in the coils of public relations, advertising, and, not to put too fine a point on it, what the world calls propaganda.
Certainly, Americans have been involved in cultural diplomacy going back to the earliest days of America. But it seems that there has been a major sort of a change. Partly, I suppose, that has to do with the Cold War. But it even seems that there is if you want to look for a kind of a major dividing line in our efforts along these lines, that perhaps it might go back as far as World War One, or the period right after World War One. That seems very. There have been a very different sort of approach to this. If you look at what happened, say before, certainly before World War Two, but maybe even before World War One, and then the period after. So not just the Cold War period, but a good part of the last century.
Right. Well, you see, the problem is that, and of course, my book is about the 20th century, so it really begins with World War One. That is when government stepped in. Before that, if we go back as far as, let's say, Ben Franklin in Paris, Ben Franklin, of course, was the greatest cultural diplomat the United States ever sent abroad. He managed to fool the French into thinking that it was in their advantage to support us in our revolution against the British and triggered their own revolution as a result of the shortfall in their economy that way. This said, it was an enormous triumph for the human spirit and for the wit of Franklin and for his genius at putting into place a whole series of ideas that absolutely captivated the French. The same was done by Jefferson in a completely different style, and oddly enough, was done by a little less responsible American named Thomas Paine, who preached a more revolutionary dogma and who did not have the kinds of restraints that both Jefferson and Franklin had in representing the nation. But in any case, it didn't really start to become a governmental function while government touched the work of the missionaries and the military, for example, had a very interesting role in education in the 19th century overseas. the merchants of America had a very interesting role. But the government was only involved marginally until the First World War, when Woodrow Wilson hired his friend George Creel to construct an agency which he thoughtfully called the Committee on Public Information. And Creel, in a letter to a friend, said, we had to use the word information because what it really is propaganda, but we can't use that word, of course, because it's a bad word. So it started really to be a vigorous government practice in the Second World War, in the First World War, and then, of course, was killed by Congress in 1919 and lay asleep until 1936, 7, 8, when the State Department began to realize that as part of its effort to reach out to Latin America, they needed cultural tools. They needed exchanges of people, of books, of ideas, of performers, of art, of all kinds of things. And so that's the way it survived until after Pearl Harbor, at which point Roosevelt was more interested in winning the war, as he should have been, of course, than in anything else. And so it took a much more dynamic, I guess you would say, dynamic and vigorous turn. I have to remind you that in the 1940s, we were at peace with Latin America, and we were at peace with places like Africa and parts of Central Asia, but essentially so that we had one kind of cultural diplomacy there. But then there were the neutral nations who were involved with us in fighting the war, and we had a different kind of cultural diplomacy with countries like Spain and Italy, and then we had a completely different kind for the enemy nations, and that's, of course, the classic tools of propaganda and so forth. But they've all been mishmashed and jumbled up together by American history, by sloppy American thinking in many cases, and by the turf battles of Washington bureaucrats.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. We'll do that. Perhaps also I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Richard Arndt. He worked for the U.S. Information Agency for 24 years after earning his Ph.D. in teaching at Columbia University. Since retiring from the USIA, he served as the president of the U.S. Fulbright Association. He chaired the National Peace Foundation. Currently, he is president of Americans for UNESCO, and he is the author of a book that looks at the history of American cultural diplomacy, or at least in the 20th century. The title of his book is The First Resort of Kings, and it is published by Potomac Books. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have two callers here ready to go, both here locally. We'll start with line one, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if you could delineate the difference between educational exchange and cultural exchange, their relationship, and then I have some other questions.
Okay. It's a very good question, actually. Cultural diplomacy in its titles in Washington has always been educational and cultural affairs. Education has always come first, and it still comes first in the title of that bureau. Now, what that means is that education is, in fact, the hard working, it does all the heavy lifting. The Fulbright program is an educational program. Now, what do we mean by culture? That's a much more interesting question, however. If I were to say that cultural diplomacy is 99% education, whether it be K through 12, university, graduate research, or public education and adult education, I would not be inaccurate. But if we said, on the other hand, what about culture, then you have to define culture. And if you mean by culture the performing arts, that was something that about 2% of our budgets went into. But by culture, we mean what the anthropologists mean. That is to say, that which distinguishes one political culture from another. One nation is different from another because they eat different foods and tell different legends and sing different songs. And within the parameters of that culture, one tries to work with educational tools in order to bring about the kinds of changes which will bring us closer together with other nations, the kinds of things we should have been doing and were doing, in fact, with Islam 40 or 50 years ago.
Well, that's my next question.
Yeah, far too inadequately and far too little.
Yeah, my next question has to do with educational and cultural exchange with the Muslim and Arab worlds, especially since 9/11 and perhaps what you think of what Tony Blair is talking about since 7/7. Sometimes I think our political leaders just are not, they step on people accidentally with their words. They just don't have a broad enough understanding.
Well, look, sure, I don't want to badmouth our political leaders, of course, but I do want to say that we've been working in educational and cultural diplomacy quite systematically and quite effectively ever since the Fulbright program was started in 1946-47. The question is not so much whether we've been doing it, the question is how much we've been doing it and how extensively in certain areas of the world. Let's take the case of Central America. In the early Reagan period, there was a report that came out, chaired by Henry Kissinger, which said that we had neglected Central America for a long time, which was one of the truer truths of the week. On the other hand, he then recommended that we send 10,000 students from Central America every year to the United States. Now, at that time, we were sending approximately 3,000 to 4,000 from the whole world. So it was the kind of absurd overkill that you expect to find when you suddenly discover great neglect. You sort of make a big noise about how we should be doing much more. The fact is, we weren't doing much in Central America, and we were doing very little in the Middle East. Now, I'd have to tell you, I warn you, I've served in Beirut. I served 5 years in Tehran. I served in Sri Lanka. And I have been in and out of the Middle East for 10 or 12 years. And it was there that I came in contact with a lot of my friends at the University of Illinois. That said, I think what we were doing in the Middle East was inadequate, but it was also controlled to some extent by the receiving nations. They didn't want us to do too much. Let me give you an interesting example. In 1975, in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi element was a troublemaker for the regime there. And so the government went into a conference with these religious leaders and said, look, stay out of our way. We're trying to run a country here. And the Wahhabis said, okay, we'll stay out of your way. Just let us run the schools. Now, I am aware of absolutely no comment, no program, nothing in 1975 on the U.S. side to either persuade them that this wasn't a very good idea or to persuade them that they better set up some countermeasures by, let's say, increasing the number of exchanges with the United States or whatever we would have done. The actual numbers of exchanges coming from the Islamic countries have been very, very few. And they have been, to some extent, tarnished by two things. One is the tendency for these countries to send very bright students who then do very well in the United States and join, at least for a temporary period, the brain drain. The other thing is that the host governments, when these bright youngsters come back, have not only always used them very well, and indeed, in many cases, they have managed to encapsulate them or to cocoon them off into harmless positions of one kind or another and keep them out of trouble. So that we're talking about a situation in which, had we done more, we might have made more progress, but on the other hand, we were fighting very real and very very well-organized fears on the part of the sending governments that education would be a danger to them. After all, education is an intervention, whether you like it or not. Even in the United States, it's an intervention. It's an intervention everywhere. Presumably, in our case, I believe anyway, in my 24 years, an intervention in the interests of human welfare and of better communications between nations and possibly of a more prosperous future for everyone concerned. That's one area where my deconstructionist friends sometimes argue with me, but generally speaking, that still remains what I believe, what I did for 24 years anyway.
Can you talk about the economics of cultural and educational exchange and its effect since 9/11 on local economies in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, look, 9/11... produced a panic reaction. We've throttled off visas and so forth and so on. And to give you the simplest example, the number of foreign students coming to this United States has diminished rather sharply. Now, and I'm told that across the world, student advisors in foreign countries are advising their kids not to go to the United States anymore. Now, we were the great educational magnet for the world for generations, for decades, and remain so. But we've made it harder with visas. We've made it harder with the stories coming out of the country about the dangers here, which, of course, are are no worse than the dangers anywhere else, but they can be made to look that way. So that the economic impact, let's look at foreign students as a simple case. The bringing a foreign student to the United States involves the kind of change we call a hidden export. If a student comes here, let's assume he's a wealthy student, can pay his own way. That student earns in foreign exchange funds for the United States anywhere from $25,000 to $30,000 or $40,000 a year. And if you aggregate that, we were bringing in by the foreign student presence in the United States something on the order of $13 billion a year, and actually it was among the top five exports of U.S. knowledge and expertise and economic goods. So it's obviously impacted on that at all levels. Local and universities are impacted. Everyone's impacted in one way or another. But we're going through a period in which we have to work out our sense or accept new kinds of vulnerability that Americans have not had to deal with in the past. The people in London are quite used to this, but we're not, and so we're working out extraordinary reactions to this, and it'll sort out in time, let's hope. Meanwhile, it certainly is an economic hardship, as you say.
Well, having lived in the Arab world, you cringe when you hear some of our politicians speak about the Arab world or the Muslim world. You feel that they just absolutely hit the wrong note.
Oh, well, yeah, there's a whole school of thought which believes that Islam is fatally flawed and must be either converted or eliminated or something or other. I don't know what they plan to do with them, but the notion that you hear from some quarters is that Islam is just hopelessly doomed and will always be inimical to U.S. interests. I don't happen to think that's true, and I've known millions and millions of people who prove the contrary, but that is one of the strands of thought that you hear running around Washington these days. I'd say that it's a minor strand and still remains a rather unimportant.
Thanks a lot, and thanks to Dave for letting me talk.
All right, let's go to line number two. We have another caller here in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hey. Perhaps you'd care to comment on what I found to be an absolutely brilliant book that apparently covers some of the same territory as your own. That's Frances Stoner Saunders, Who Paid the Piper? She reveals how the CIA, from the Second World War through the 1960s even, conducted a huge secret propaganda campaign in the area of culture. Amazing stories, and many of them very funny.
Yeah, well, you know, Frances Saunders' book, I'm not a fan of Frances Saunders, as you seem to be, so...
You think you would be.
Yeah, you know, I think basically she is a... Well, look, let's start with the fact that she's a British journalist. And a TV journalist, in fact. So that I don't expect from her much more than what she says. But, you know, when you start looking into what the CIA did, you're talking about a lot of stuff on which you have to base it on hearsay. There are no documents. It's unfortunate, but those will only come to light with time. So that I find her book very unreliable. I find some of her stories very funny, but I wish I were more certain they were true. Interviewing the wives of some of the participants doesn't necessarily prove the point. On the other hand, in my own book, I have a half a chapter on, well, not quite 4 or 5 pages, on the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And I put it this way. I think this is the truth that I came to, and I've meditated this for many, many years, and that is that the Congress was an absolute necessity. In 1947, 48, 49, if someone had gone to the U.S. Congress and said, we want to set up an intellectual organization to connect the intellectuals, the finest intellectuals in the world, and to harness them as an assault or a defense or a way to reach the NCL, as they call it, the non-communist left. If you had said that to Congress, you wouldn't have gotten a nickel to do it. So they had to hide it in the CIA if it was to be done at all. I would say that on the basis of my experience, for at least the first decade, it was done extremely well. It was done with remarkable people involved. Shep Stone, there's a good book on Shep Stone by a man named Volker Berghahn about all of this. It was done extremely well by brilliant people with lavish amounts of money. The problem was that they forgot that they had to develop an exit strategy, and when they were caught with their pants down, as it were, in 1967, 68, by the Ramparts article, many, many careers and lives were destroyed, and a great deal of the goodwill that had been built up over the years, the trust in the United States, was tarnished, to say the very least. In parts of the world, it may have been destroyed. So I frankly think it was too bad that it worked out that way, but on the other hand, that it was a necessity that someone do it. And because it was
a strange notion of necessity that would bring the CIA into a vast structure of lies where it would not even say publicly what it was trying to do.
No, that's not what I'm...
The notion that manipulation of culture and scholarship is appropriate because you couldn't have got it through the Congress if you did it openly seems an amazing justification for a mendacious program.
Sure.
And that's what Stoner Saunders reveals.
Yeah, well, I don't think she proves her point. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that the manipulation was far less on its audiences than it was of the U.S. Congress. We were simply trying to find some way to do something that had to be done because the Soviets were organizing and mobilizing every single aspect of human life with some kind of an organization, which had in some way or other to be countered or resisted or dealt with or met or whatever. And that is what things were what the climate was like in that particular period. And it's too bad that
the notion of what the Soviets were doing had any truth to it. It still would have been appropriate to do it openly, to say it publicly. The reason the CIA couldn't say it publicly was because it was clear that what they were doing was to promote American corporate interests in Europe, and it was unwilling and unable to argue about that openly because it would have been laughed off the continent if it had been.
Well, if you want to see it that way, you may. It's not the way I see it.
Well, I suggest Stoner Saunders' book, which is far more scholarly than you suggest. She's looked at the document, she's talked to the people, and apparently a lot of other people have not done that.
Well, I thank you for the call. We'll go on here. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I actually was going to ask about Stoner Saunders, too, and the way you say we were doing it makes me think that maybe you had some active role in the project. But actually, the other point I wanted to ask about is, and we'll all have to take a grain of salt here, it seems to be your UNESCO booster. There have been various ways of trying to manipulate it, and, well, the worst part of the U.S. history was complete defunding during the Reagan administration and sort of the ostracizing and all these false allegations about licensing journalists and all that. When really something like the McBride Report, One World, Many Voices, call for diversity in the airwaves was probably much more seen as much more of a threat. But so I just wanted you to tell us what you thought of that episode, and then also, are we still funding UNESCO a la carte, or do we actually have a program to fund it in and I would say also maybe in a sort of authentically cooperative way as opposed to a
good question.
Co-opting way, maybe.
Good question. First of all, let me deal with the we. When I say we, I meant the United States. I joined the government in 1961. The Congress would have been over in 4 or 5 years, and our cultural services had absolutely nothing to do with it. In fact, we had probably too little to do with it because we were sort of off limits for us. It's too bad about that. But when I say we, I mean the U.S. government was faced with some what they perceived to be needs to carry out, and they did it in the only way that they found to be available. I agree with you that it would have been nice if we could have done it And in fact, maybe we could have done it. Maybe less well, but we might have been able to do it. But that's another story. When I say we, I mean the U.S. government. I only joined in 61. Now, as for UNESCO, I yield to none in saying that the United States withdrawal in 1984 was an absolute disaster. The organization I now head, called Americans for UNESCO, was founded specifically in order to lobby, that's not the right word, in order to persuade the American people that we should get back into UNESCO. And in September of 2002, the president announced that we would rejoin UNESCO, and we did, and we are now back into UNESCO. We've reduced our total contribution from 25% to 22%, which amounts to about $60 or $65 million a year, which will not build even half of one fighter plane. And we're back now. We have an ambassador in charge. We have a U.S. National Commission, and things are more or less working well. As for your characterization of how we pulled out in 1984, you're absolutely right. The allegations were that the press freedom was being affected by this pitiful little organization in Paris, which had really nothing to do with it, except that it was arguing and trying to make the world understand that globalization in the information world impacts very heavily upon tiny countries who cannot defend themselves against this onslaught of information, and was suggesting that this thing ought to be looked at as a world problem. Our press got quite huffy about that, and that was the major reason why we pulled out in 1984, although there were many other reasons, by the way. I'll direct you to an article in our little magazine, which we call Prospects and Retrospects, on the withdrawal by a man named Leonard Sussman, who was one of the participants, who makes it perfectly clear what the game was about.
Does the caller want to...
Well, I guess it just gives me an opportunity to say hurrah for another brilliant woman journalist, and that would be Phyllis Bennis and her story about UNESCO, and she also has one more broadly about the UN and the way the U.S. has been controlling it. Thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Richard Arndt, and we are talking about cultural diplomacy and a little bit about American cultural diplomacy over the last century. He's written about this in his book. It's titled The First Resort of Kings. It's published by Potomac Books. And again, just to give you his little bit of background, he worked for the U.S. Information Agency for 24 years, that after earning a doctorate in teaching at Columbia. Since retiring from the USIA, he served as president of the U.S. Fulbright Association. He chaired the National Peace Foundation. Currently, he is president of an organization called Americans for UNESCO. And he's joining us this morning by phone. He makes his home in Washington, D.C. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Given the fact that now around the world there are a lot of people who have a rather low opinion of the United States, given the fact that there is so much now of what we have discussed, the public diplomacy, some people would say, and that's a nice way of saying propaganda. What does that mean for the potential receptivity of, if there is such a word, of audiences around the world, of individuals around the world for cultural diplomacy? I mean, how, given all that, given all the negativity about the United States, how open to the idea of cultural diplomacy are people?
You know, having messed it up, it's going to be hard to build our way back in there. And I'm not so sure it'll ever be the same. When we started this in 1938, in the period after 1946 and all the rest, we were building on an enormous reservoir of goodwill, which had been built up over a century and a half, starting with Franklin in Paris and carried out by the missionary educators and the philanthropists and God knows what else. All over the world, the Americans were looked upon as the best hope for the world in many, many important areas and as a world leader. Now, those reservoirs were then filled even further by the way the programs were devised. The Fulbright program was devised not to propagandize anybody, but to spend money for educational purposes that would be decided upon by a commission representing both nations equally, and this binational focus would allow people to exchange university students and faculty and so forth without there being any threat of a, in the narrow sense, a political purpose to it. I say the narrow sense in the sense of the short range. We don't expect that bringing a Fulbright to the United States to study at Chicago is going to make him vote our way in the UN 5 years from now. We only expect that he may understand the United States a lot better when he votes in the UN and may understand the explanations that we're trying to give him to explain what we're doing. Now, the point is this. We are in a period now where we have squandered a great deal of this capital that we've built up over a couple hundred years, and it's going to be very hard to get it back. We are now almost a world pariah in this regard, and for one reason or another, perhaps justifiable, I don't happen to think so, but that is the way it is right now. How we will change that, how we will build back that kind of cooperative spirit, that kind of binational unanimity that we had, and that certainly in my 24 years abroad, I exercised every day of my life. I don't know how we're going to do it. It's going to be very hard. But I'll tell you the simplest answer I can give you. The first thing we need in every embassy in the world is a cultural office. And that cultural, and I don't mean a public diplomacy office. I mean a cultural office. And my recommendation in country X would be that that office would be headed by one of the great American scholars of that country, and that that person would speak the language, that that person would know its history, that that person would know its people from top to bottom. If we had, there are 190 countries roughly in the world, if we had 190 cultural attachés of that caliber out there, we could start, we could make a beginning. And if we then had funds to back up exchanges, sending students abroad and so forth, over time, we could slowly begin to change things. But there's one problem with all of this, and that is that you cannot make a bad policy good by cultural diplomacy. You have to have decent, respectful, two-way binational kinds of policy decisions in the first place, and I think we're a little bit short of that nowadays.
Well, this touches on another problem, and that is something that you address in the book. I think when you look back and look at the fact that we do, over time at least, have a fairly strong tradition of scholar diplomats, certainly at least a handful of people whose names stand out, is it difficult to find people like that now, or is it that we certainly have the scholars and they're not interested in being diplomats? Is there something about the diplomatic service that discourages those kind of people?
Yeah, well, there are three phases of history, David. For the first 150 years or so, all the diplomats were political appointees, and they came from the top of the American elite. They were appointed they were friends of the president, and you would send Nathaniel Hawthorne to Liverpool because he'd done a campaign biography, but also because he was Nathaniel Hawthorne. And on it went. The second phase was in the period before the First World War, there began to emerge some very high-quality people who became sort of professional diplomats and served alternate administrations one way or the other just because they were so very, very good. Then in 1924, the Rogers Act established a foreign service, a formal, official foreign service, just like the other countries of the world. And since 1924, we've had that foreign service in place, and it's been, by and large, a good foreign service. However, the American model has never accepted sending more than, let's say, 60% of its ambassadors from the professional core. There are always the professional, the political appointments, and of course these people, there's a great temptation for these people to be campaign contributors. There have also been men like John Kenneth Galbraith who have been great intellectual leaders who were sent out to Delhi. There have been people like that, but by and large the ambassadors have been political friends of the president, and that's the way it's been. So if you turned around tomorrow and said, golly, let's send nothing but regional area specialists to all of the countries as ambassadors, you'd probably have a lot of volunteers right there on the campus in Urbana. I don't think there's any shortage of people. In fact, if you wanted to just send a few cultural attachés, not ambassadors, from the Urbana campus, you'd find a good dozen people raring to go asking, where do they sign up today? So that it's not a problem. It's not a problem of people. The people are there. It's a problem of a political process which still sees diplomacy as something that is best left to the political discourse of the nation, in the short term sense, in the sense of politics as defined as winning elections. We need, it seems to me, in foreign policy, to take a far longer view. After all, you wouldn't appoint a heart surgeon or a commander of an aircraft carrier or the president of a university because he'd made a large contribution to your campaign. I think you'd be risking your life in the case of the heart surgeon. So what we need is a sense of professionalism in diplomacy and a sense then within that professionalism of a higher intellectual caliber, at least in certain functions in the embassies.
Let us talk with some other callers. Next is Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if you talk about in your book the fact that we have never pulled out of the cultural scene. I think basically you're not looking at the fact that we have allowed Hollywood TV programs and CDs, music, to be our cultural diplomats, because we basically have a, at least I guess the Republicans have often felt that anything government can do, business can do better. And that fact is that all this time we were out of UNESCO, I think we felt quite confident that through movies, through television programs, and through our music, we would be able to convince these people, the people around the world, what wonderful people we were. And as my understanding, at least in the 80s, most American embassies or consulates had a cultural aspect to it. I can't remember the name of the group that runs it, but quite often they were called Kennedy Centers. And as I remember, one of the things they often did was simply show American movies, which goes back to my point that I hope you discuss in your book and maybe you want to discuss now, is the fact that we have our government, and many times has been quite content to allow corporations to promote American culture, even though that has, I don't think, presented the best sides of American culture.
Well, that's a brilliant question, and it raises a whole bunch of answers. The installations you were thinking of overseas were called USIS, and they had that was where the cultural office was lodged, and very often there was the cultural center, which could be called the Franklin Center or the Kennedy Center or whatever it was, and they were very vigorous, and we taught English in all those centers, and we had libraries and so forth. All of that has been washed away. And it hasn't been washed away by one party or by the other. It's been a very lovely collaboration between Democrats and Republicans. The libraries disappeared in 1994, 1996. The performing and fine arts programs were all washed away in 1994. But the decline, the erosion, as I call it in the book, has been more or less constant ever since, let's say, 1960. Mm-hmm. So that's the first point. The second thing about the private sector doing culture abroad, the Hollywood problem, there are two dilemmas that we face here. First of all, how is the government expected to control that? Obviously, we don't have a government which is about to censor films or to insist that such films, that things don't happen. We have very few controls over that. We have few controls over publication. And I think most Americans like it that way and prefer it that way. When I first went into the field, I was stunned by the images that foreigners had from pop culture.
Yes.
It was absolutely overwhelming. And they knew everything about the United States, you know. It was just so clear. And so you would say, well, where'd you get that idea? And, you know, they would say, well, we saw it on Dallas, you know, or whatever.
Yes.
It was. So that we consciously set ourselves up as not necessarily correcting the images, but let's say completing them, left by something like the Dallas phenomenon. So that when we are accused, as we sometimes are, of having fostered a kind of a high culture approach in our cultural offices, I would have said at the time that, look, the low culture is pretty well taken care of. It's flooding this country. And in fact, what we really ought to do and need to do is remind people that the United States is the leading educator in the world. It's the leading music producer. I'm talking about serious music as well as video and stuff. It's the repository of Western civilization in many ways, and people just don't get a chance to see that through our popular culture.
I appreciate what you're saying, but my question was directly addressed to us. I really feel that many people in government are quite comfortable with businesses being promoting our view, and I think because so few people in our government really travel extensively, they aren't aware, as you are, of the Dallas phenomenon and how much that has impressed people, even people you would think would be more sophisticated, such as Europeans, have given them such a strong impression of us. And for many of these people in government, they are quite content because they see it as more business, which is good for our economy, and they're satisfied with that culture being promoted because they feel it saves taxpayers money and we're promoting American culture. I'm suggesting that. That's my impression. I'm not sure you have more contact with people in Washington. Perhaps you've gotten a different impression.
Let me give you an interesting example, because this has waxed and waned. You know, when I first went into government, it was not we didn't really look to the corporate world for any kind of support of our programs. We didn't expect that. I'll give you an example. In 1964, the Ford Motor Company in Germany went to the Fulbright Commission and offered to fund a group of scholarships to pay for them, provided that the candidates would come down and interview in Cologne at the Ford plant. And the commission consulted with Washington and decided to turn that down because they didn't want that kind of corporate interference that might possibly look like commercial overlay to the Fulbright program. So there's always been a waxing and waning. Now, in recent years, there has been, within the last 10, 20 years, there has been much more openness to letting the private sector not only into things, but to literally do things. Overseas, for example, when I was in Europe, the orchestras that would be brought were always backed by some major corporate backer and had advertisement all over them. That's come to be more or less understood in the world. In my time, it was not that at all. It was the Ford Foundation didn't really speak for Ford. It carried the name, but it didn't really try to sell Fords, and the Rockefeller Foundation didn't try to sell oil. They were extraordinary bodies which were built to be free of the corporate influence, just as the universities, which accept corporate money, are very careful to insulate themselves from from university decision making, too much influenced by the corporations. So that there's a waxing and waning of this. Now, as for the government people, I mean, there are lots of them, and I don't know two who agree on much of anything. Actually, they do what they can, but they're really not a class or a race. They're very different people, and I don't think very many of them are terribly happy about the onslaught of pop culture that's really swamped the globe in the last 20 or 30 years. In terms of what it does, I don't think they care that it happens, but in terms of what it does, in terms of the way it makes the United States look, I don't think anybody's terribly happy about that. To have a song in which people are encouraged to beat on the brat with a baseball bat. That sort of thing is not doing the American image any good. And it's the welfare of this country, as a preceding caller said, to some extent is depends upon this exchange of students and students wanting to come here and to feel welcome to come here and to feel that they will not be mugged or assassinated or whatever in the streets. So that the pop culture is a bit of a problem, but again, as I said in my work, what we said was, let us see what the pop culture is doing. Let us stay out of that, but let us try to put another layer on top of that so that the pop culture can be put into a context.
We are going to have to stop there. We have one more caller. I'm sorry we can't take, but we're simply at the end of the time. If you would like to read more on this particular subject, you can look for the book that we mentioned a couple of times. It's entitled The First Resort of Kings, American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century. It's published by Potomac Books by our guest, Richard Arntz. He worked for the U.S. Information Agency for 24 years. He served as president of the U.S. Fulbright Association. Currently, he is president of a group called Americans for UNESCO. And Mr. Arntz, we want to say to you, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, David. Thanks a lot.